Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you here as we wrap up another week. On Fridays, once a month, on this day, in fact, we have a show dedicated to answering questions about money management, personal finance. Most of the shows we have as our guest, Dave Sinha. He's President, CEO, Strategic Capital Bank. He wasn't able to be with us this morning, and we went looking for a substitute, and we think we found someone who is pretty able to answer some of the same sorts of questions. As our guest today, we have Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in finance, Department of Finance at U of I, where he teaches courses in financial markets and investments. He has been with the U of I since 1996, and before that worked for a number of financial institutions in the community, including Champaign National Bank, E.F. Hutton, Shearson American Express, and the Illinois Company. And if your memory's long enough, you might remember the time when he was one of those guys that did stock market updates for us during the day. He was good enough to come over and spend the morning, and we'll try to do the same kind of program here. The idea is if you have questions about your own investment decisions and you're not quite sure which way to go, I know that he will give you some advice and some things to think about. All you have to do is call in, ask your question, and he will do his best. So the number here, as always, 333-9455. We do have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, locally, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's good to be back.
We seem to be in a confusing, frustrating, difficult time for a lot of folks when it comes to their investments in the stock market. We've gone from a period when it seemed that every day we were setting new highs, that there was just nowhere to go but up, into a period where there's real volatility and you just don't know from one day to the next what is going to happen. How do you shift the way that you think when you're going from one kind of a market to this kind?
That's a great question. I think I'd like to focus on the word shift. For people that didn't get too caught up in the everyday new record high syndrome, what's going on now is probably no upsetting feature to them. So if the perspective is a long-term perspective, the highs don't bother us, the lows don't bother us, the day-to-day, even month-to-month or year-to-year volatility shouldn't really bother us. It's the long-term path that makes the most sense.
Yeah. Well, that's the kind of thing that I continue to hear. And when Dave's here, he sort of says the same thing. Recently, when you see various kinds of brokers and financial advisors interview, they all say the same thing. If your goal, if it's retirement and it's 10 or 15 or 20 years away, don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. Stay the course. Be a regular saver, be a regular investor, be as diversified as you possibly can, and that chances are very good that in 15 or 20 years, the market's going to be higher than it is today. There may be ups and downs, but having said that, though, if your horizon is shorter, I mean, what, mm-hmm. you know, supposing that you're 10 years or less, fewer, away from retirement, how much should you be in the market, in stocks?
Yeah, as a person's horizon gets closer to being, what should we say, needing to liquidate investments and live on that capital, then the conditions certainly change and a person needs to become more cautious, less exposed to volatile markets, whether they're stocks or long-term bonds, either one. But there's still probably a good reason to have a portion of a person's wealth exposed. It is the life cycle of investments that we talk about when we talk about a person's needs and their objectives as they move through time and get closer to their goals. So that's an important consideration. It needs to be something that is tuned over time.
The one, again, sort of a standard piece of advice that a lot of financial advisors give is you ought to be broadly diversified, and as much as possible, you ought to invest in the whole market. And in fact, now there are a lot of mutual funds that are called things like total market index. So mm-hmm. that does not mean that you're investing in every stock, but that you're getting close. You're investing in a lot of different things. Some of the big ones, some of the middle ones, some of the smaller ones. Have those kind of funds taken as big a hit as the specific sectors where there's been real volatility, like the high tech?
They haven't taken as big a hit as those sector funds that are concentrated in the more volatile sectors. Let's really define what you're talking about. The essence of index investing is pretty much the cornerstone of modern portfolio theory. Going back to the 1950s and the debate that has raged ever since, which is basically that between passive or active investment style management, the passive style being own the whole market. And there are, as you mentioned, a whole scad of ways to own the whole market now, or great portions of it, and own it very economically. The alternative to that is the active style of investment management, and that's security selection. So picking stocks, picking individual bonds, picking individual mutual funds that specialize in certain areas. And I think that debate will always rage, the benefits or drawbacks of either style of investment management. What is true and what probably will remain true, though, is any unbiased study of historical returns, you will see that the passive investment style of management has been a more profitable path to follow. And a lot of that has to do with how you measure those investment returns, especially with the active investment managers. But the bottom line remains is that it appears the evidence is in favor of a passive investment approach. For a person who has a long-term horizon, to take that approach is probably the safest, best rewarding way to go.
Yeah. Although it was interesting, just recently I saw an article in a newspaper talking about the fact that online brokers have really started to have hard times because people now are nervous. Mm-hmm. They don't want to pick their own stocks, and the traditional brokers are suddenly finding people are streaming in the doors again because they think that they'll make better choices, and that those people who said in the past, oh, you can do it yourself, we'll give you a couple of tips, but we're going to save you a lot of money on your transaction mm-hmm. costs. Those services looks like they're headed for a hard time.
Well, I've always believed that transaction costs are the cheapest form of investment expenses. So it's the big picture that counts. For a person who feels comfortable making their own decisions and making their own choices, it's really little different now than it was 30 or 20 years ago, in saying that people that feel comfortable and want to do their own investment selection, whether it's taking the approach to an overall asset allocation or even going deeper than that into specific security selection, again, if they keep their head about them, don't get caught up in trends and waves and popularity contests, so to speak, they'll do just fine. For those people that want advice, want a sounding board, so to speak, a full-service broker still serves a very useful purpose.
Okay. We got as our guest here in the studio today, Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance at University of Illinois. He teaches courses on financial markets and investments. This is our monthly show on personal finance. You have questions, I know Kevin will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have some callers here. We'll start with Terre Haute, and that's line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the P.E. ratios of the different indexes and what their record highs and record lows have been and what their traditional average could be expected and where you think they're going from here, and do you think there's been any fundamental change from the traditional P.E. ratios? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you. That's an interesting question, and there's been a lot of recent articles about P.E. ratios, how they measure a stock market's value, what they mean in terms of the stock's desirability. Well, let's just look at a little bit of the present situation. If we were to look at the Standard & Poor's 500 Index, probably one of the more common indices of a broad-based, large capitalization stock market. Right now, the P.E. ratio on the S&P 500 is in the 24 neighborhood. And a P.E. ratio, for those that want a little explanation behind the jargon, price per share divided by earnings per share of the company. So if we had a single company whose earnings or profits were divided among the number of shares of stock that single company had outstanding, we'd call that the earnings per share of the company. We take the price of the stock is the numerator, divide it by that earnings per share figure, and voila, a P.E. ratio appears. As an index, if we use the Standard & Poor's 500 index, those 500 stocks' earnings all in the denominator, the prices all in the index itself in the numerator, and we have a P.E. ratio for an index or a market measure. So at 24 times earnings, the P.E. on the S&P 500 right now is a little lower than it was a year ago at roughly 29 times earnings. As it compares to a long-term average, if we were to look back over the past 25 to 30 years, we'd say that a more normal level would be somewhere in the 15-16 neighborhood. Here's how a P.E. ratio works in my mind. It's sort of like a thermometer. It's a relative indicator of people's willingness to buy stocks based on the present level of earnings capabilities of those companies. And it's sort of an assessment, or maybe an Ed Kieser forecast into the future of people's anticipations of companies' ability to grow their earnings. So the higher the P.E. ratio, for instance, the more optimistic investors are on the prospects of companies' abilities to grow their earnings faster. The lower the earnings ratio, then the more pessimistic they are. I'd have to say right now the situation is probably like a pendulum. Maybe 18 months ago, when the Dow Industrial Average was at its high, when the Standard & Poor's 500 was at its high, roughly 12 months ago when the NASDAQ was at its high, P.E. ratios were probably out of hand. I believe the S&P 500 P.E. ratio peaked at around 38 times earnings, and that, like a pendulum, was probably the extreme in its path, excuse me, as it swings between the two extremes. Maybe 15 is a little too low. And I guess the big $64,000 question is, where is the middle point? But I think we'll see P.E. ratios continue to come down a little bit as investors temper their expectations of growth prospects in the future.
Okay. Hope that gets the question of the caller. Others are welcome. We have another caller standing by here locally in Champaign, and that would be line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to work you out nearly as hard as the last guy. I don't know a P.E. ratio from the gear ratio in the back of my Carmen Ghia, but my question is, I'm one of those guys that drives around listening to WILL and listening to the show thinking, gosh, that's interesting, but I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm finally in a position where I can begin to save a little money, and I have no idea where to begin. So I want to back way up in your expertise. Where does a guy married 20 years from retirement begin?
Good question. The first question I'd have to throw back to you is, do you have any employer-sponsored retirement plan that you can avail yourself to?
Yes, I do.
Great. I would find out as much as I could about that retirement plan and see what kinds of flexibilities it had, what kinds of requirements it had. Basically get to know it as well as the HR person at the firm that you work with.
All right.
And after having done that, sit down with a 20-year horizon and basically tell yourself that if history is any guide, the first thing that we ought to remember is the more you save, the more you'll have in the future. So if it's a salary reduction program, 401k, 403b type of plan, the more you can afford to save now, the more you'll have in the future. Next, into the allocation of those savings dollars, where are they going to go? Again, if history is any guide, you'll probably say that taking some risk is going to have produced along a higher rate of return. Risk and return are fairly well linked. The higher the risk of the money you place into an investment strategy, the higher the expected rate of return. So that means, for the most part, an exposure to stocks. There's probably going to be a menu of options that you can choose among for investments, and you know, if you need some help with defining what those options are, what they're entailing, how they work, so on and so forth, the HR person, again, at your firm is probably the first place to start.
Okay. I'm 2% from maxing out that fund. Where would I go? What would be the best place to go after that?
Okay. If you're fortunate enough to have additional capacity to save,
yes, sir.
Then I would look into a Roth IRA. If you're already close to maxing out on the pre-tax savings part of the employer-sponsored plan, Roth IRAs are great additions. Unlike a traditional IRA, you will not be able to make pre-tax contributions to it. These are after-tax dollars that are going into the Roth IRA. They have some benefits on the withdrawal time, though. If the account's been opened at least 5 years, if you are over age 59 and a half and you pull the money out of the Roth IRA, all of the money comes out with no tax implications. So that's not only the contributions you put in that were after-tax dollars, but also the earnings on the account come out tax-free, so to speak. So the Roth IRA, you're allowed to contribute up to $2,000 a year for yourself, for your spouse. So that's another potential $2,000 or $4,000 savings opportunity for you.
Well, that about maxes what I'm able to do, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Well,
thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You have a question for our guest, Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in finance at University of Illinois. Maybe just for a second, I don't want to snow people with this, but maybe we might go back to the price-earnings ratio just to make sure that people understand really what it is we're talking about. Basically, it's a calculation where you take what the stock is selling for, essentially, and comparing that with how the company's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the concern that a lot of people have had during the boom time was that if you look at how the company was doing and then you look at what their stock was selling for, you'd have to say, wait a minute, this mm-hmm. stock is selling way too high. And that it was based on, as you said, people's sort of gut feeling about not just how that company was doing today, but the possibility for that company
sure.
in the future.
And many times, not a gut feeling, but a very analytical feeling. The analysts that would put out the research reports that would forecast sales and profits for a company 10 years into the future.
Mm-hmm. But this was the thing that for those people who were nervous, who were saying, oh, the market's flying too high, sooner or later it's going to hit the wall. This was one of the things that they were looking at as evidence. They were saying, well, look at here. Look at what people are paying for stocks, and look at how these companies are doing. That can't go on.
Mm-hmm.
And as you've said already, we've seen some correction, some pulling back in that. You think maybe we might see a little bit more?
Yeah, it's not unbelievable at all. And again, a little bit like the analogy to the thermometer. If it were the dog days of August and I looked at my thermometer and found it to be 100 degrees Fahrenheit, I'd probably be unwise to lay in tons and tons of ice for the coming months in anticipation of that 100 degree temperature staying. So a little like the thermometer. It's showing us a relative level of investors' optimism or pessimism as it relates to a company's earnings prospects. When a company is growing very fast, and there have been many companies that have grown tremendously fast over the past 10 years, much of the technological innovation, much of the electronic revolution, much of the internet fascination and productivity increases that we've seen in our economy have much to do with the fast rates of growth of many of these companies who, let's say 4 or 5 years ago when they first went public, were not making any money. And as recently as 18 months ago, may not have made any money or made very, very small amounts of profits. But at the same time, the optimism, the desirability of those stocks was such that people were literally paying thousands of times earnings to buy the company's shares. There are still a handful of companies today that you can look at who have PE multiples in 3 or 4 digits. And, of course, there are companies that are still yet not making money, so a P.E. ratio doesn't even exist. There are no earnings in the denominator to divide the price by. And those kinds of optimistic showings, again, like the thermometer, show relative degrees of optimism or pessimism on the part of investors. And I think investors probably got a little over-optimistic. Mm-hmm. And they may be approaching a time soon when they get a little overly pessimistic.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Let's go to Southern Illinois, and that would be line 4. Hello.
Hi. My husband recently lost his job through downsizing and has a 401k at work that we need to take out and roll into something else. And I was wondering if you could talk about self-directed IRAs, or is there a self-directed IRA? and what's the difference between Roth and regular IRAs and some online investing?
Sure. Sorry to hear of the circumstance that you mentioned. When a person separates service from their employer, in whatever circumstance brought that about, they are eligible, as you've mentioned, to be able to pull the money out of the qualified retirement plan. I would advise anybody in a circumstance of distribution, however they came there, whatever the circumstance brought them there, to roll the money from the 401k plan directly into a self-directed IRA account. Now, this would be a standard or traditional IRA account, not the Roth. We'll get to that in a moment. When they do, they are able then to control those monies more directly. If it's a circumstance where money is needed for living expenses, you'll be much easier or able to get at the money if it's in a self-directed IRA rather than going through the employer's retirement plan if the money still stays there, which is, by the way, a prerogative. A participant can choose to leave the money in the employer's retirement plan if they wish.
No, it wasn't a good plan.
Okay.
It was Putnam, and they were losing, and like everybody, but they were not very good.
Okay. In moving the money to a self-directed IRA, then you know now what type of account to establish. Where you establish it now is your choice. Banks, mutual fund companies, brokerage houses, insurance companies, almost anybody that handles money is in the business of being able to set up an IRA account. I would say that for any person, setting up an IRA account is a little bit like choosing a doctor. If you don't know someone who works in the financial services industry, ask some friends, ask some family members if they work with somebody and trust them, like what they're doing, and basically just seek some help, get some guidance. It would be like you or I or anyone else moving to a different area and having to choose a different family doctor. We'd probably ask friends, cohorts, wherever, people that we trusted for some advice as to where to begin. And once the IRA is set up at that institution, choosing how the money gets invested is the next step. That, in part, will depend upon how your needs are at present with your husband unemployed. Obviously, I wouldn't be making any investments in anything that has any market value fluctuation with any of the funds that you think you might need to draw from the account to live on. Aside from that, if some of the money will be there for a longer period of time, then you can explore opportunities that have growth potential more so than just a savings account, so to speak.
But we have to go through a bank or another institution in order to roll it over.
Yes. An IRA account is not an account that you could establish as an individual. It does require some amount of paperwork that the IRS has signed off on. But again, a bank, a credit union, there are a myriad of financial institutions that you probably have associations with already that can offer you very cost-effective, simple IRA accounts. At the very least, a bank or a credit union could set up an IRA account that could act as the initial repository of the money from the qualified retirement plan and allow you time to shop and see where you wanted it to go eventually.
Okay, and what's the difference between the Roth and the regular IRA?
Yeah, the Roth IRA is really a hybrid account that's just come about in the past few years. The Roth IRA is an account that can only accept after-tax money into it. In the circumstance that you'd mentioned now, for a person taking a distribution from a qualified retirement plan, those are pre-tax dollars that would come out of that plan, and they would be subject to income tax and possibly a 10% excise or penalty tax for a person who takes the money out and spends it before age 59 and a half. Even after age 59 and a half, they're still subject to income taxes. So the caveat, I should say, or the kind of catch, if a person wants to move qualified money from an employer retirement plan into a Roth IRA, they have to do it in a stepwise function, and they'll end up paying income tax on all of the money that they move out of the plan. So here's what they do. The money would come out of the 401k plan, into a regular IRA account. As it's doing that, no tax implications whatsoever. The person sets up a Roth IRA account and transfers the money into it, but that money that comes out of the IRA account immediately becomes subject to income tax. The income tax is due and payable at that time and needs to be paid from monies other than the actual money rolled into the Roth IRA.
Oh, I see.
Otherwise, we get into a catch-22. The dollars that are taken from the IRA or from the 401k plan, if you want to go back to its origin, that are used to pay the tax dollars would also be subject to a 10% excise tax because they did not end up being rolled into a 401k plan.
So it's a 10% tax?
Yes, those monies would be subject to normal income tax as well as a 10% excise tax.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. A little bit past our midpoint here. Talking with Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance at University of Illinois. He teaches courses in financial markets and investments. He's filling in this month for Dave Sinnoh. This is our regular monthly show on personal finance. Dave just wasn't able to be with us today, and we went out looking for a substitute, and Kevin said, yeah, he would come over and do this, so we appreciate his being here. I know he'll do his best to answer your questions. If you'd like to call in, we have, I think our lines are about to be full, so we take it the people in the order in which they came in. The number, if you'd like to call us, though, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. And then the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Our next caller in line is Line 1 in that Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a similar problem. My husband was downsized and lost a job last year. He used his retirement, and they put it in a mutual fund, which is a third high, third mid, and a third low risk. Now, my question is, I had a small house of my own that I just have sold, and I'm wondering what to do with the profit that I'll get from that, because we need some liquid funds for emergencies, because I'm the only income coming in. And our house is right now currently 7.5% interest on the mortgage loan. I could pay off the house we currently live on with this, or would you recommend something that is rather safe, like a money market or a mutual fund or something with annuity, something that whatever I would need to do with this money that might be the best way to go with it?
From what I've heard, my direction tends toward a conservative or a careful posture. Perhaps to begin with, certainly put the money in a money market fund at a bank or a credit union and be able to explore the ramifications of all of the different elements that you mentioned to me. First of all, your husband, I presume, is currently still not working?
Correct.
Okay. Then we're, you know, we need to be conservative and talk about the possibility of using part of that money for living expenses.
Mm-hmm.
The element of the sale of another house brings in the capital gains issue. Now we get into whether or not those funds should be rolled into another property to postpone the paying of gains tax. I'm really seeing a lot of different elements here, and I may suggest that probably you'd be best served in talking to a CPA
mm-hmm.
who could take you through all of the different elements and all of the different ramifications of what options lay before you.
Great. Thank you for your help.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Just for a second, on a recent show, one of the last shows I think that Dave was here, we had someone who was a little confused about money market accounts. And now there are accounts that I guess that's the wording that I would use to describe them, things that are essentially interest-bearing mm-hmm. checking accounts. But mm-hmm. there are also money market mutual funds. And,
right.
and I guess I'm not real clear on what the difference between those two things are.
Right. That's a good distinction because we use the terms almost interchangeably, and it's really not correct to do so. A money market mutual fund is a mutual fund offered by an investment company. So whether it's Fidelity, Janus, any one of hundreds of different mutual fund companies, a money market mutual fund is a special type of mutual fund, and it invests only in money market instruments, things like commercial paper, large negotiable CDs issued by banks, U.S. Treasury bills, all of the short-term fixed income type of investments that at the time they're originally issued or sold by the issuing body are things that mature within 60, 90, 180 days. As such, a money market mutual fund then invests in very liquid, very short-term fixed income instruments, and like any other mutual fund, pools money from individual investors into a multi-billion dollar portfolio of these types of investments. A money market mutual fund has a goal of maintaining a $1 net asset value, but that's a goal, not a guarantee. So in the past 30, 35 years of the existence of money market mutual funds, we remind ourselves that there's never been a mutual fund of money market instruments that has broken the buck, quote-unquote. In other words, an investor taking money out received back less than a dollar of principal they put in. But there's certainly no guarantee that they won't in the future, and the mutual fund company makes it plain that the dollar you put in there can be more or less than a dollar when you pull it out. Highly improbable, but still possible. And that's the key distinction now between the money market that you'll open at a bank, savings and loan, credit union. Those are insured funds. So like any other insured deposit at that insured institution, the dollar that you put there is always the dollar plus the interest that you earn. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's the guarantee.
And there, so if you have some money and you think that you may need to get at some of it, not maybe not routinely, but maybe once or twice a month, if that much, you're going to have some of that money, mm-hmm. and you'd like to put it in some place that's safe and some place where you're going to earn some interest. Then really, what you're talking about is the account that they offer at the bank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the biggest distinction is whether we're talking about a transactions type of an account or a savings account. If it's money's, let's say for my example. I put money away routinely to pay the property taxes that are due on the house. And in June and September, I need to tap that account to pay the property taxes. But I know that I will only tap that account twice a year. So a money market mutual fund is a fine thing to be able to put the money into. In June, I can make a withdrawal to pay the first installment. In September, I make a withdrawal to pay the second installment. The rest of the months of the year, I continue to put money into the account to fund it so that the money is there to pay the property taxes. If it's that type of frequency, then I would call that more or less a savings type of an account rather than a transactions type of an account. At the credit union, I also have a checking account and a savings account, and I move money between those two just for operational purposes, if you want to call it that. So I guess potential frequency of moving money into and out of those accounts is probably the easiest way I differentiate between them.
Okay. Well, we've got some other folks to talk to. Let's do that. Next will be Glenn Allen. And this is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. Earlier you used the phrase catch-22, and here's kind of a tough catch-22 question for you. Many years ago, I remember when I had unemployment was not taxed. Now it's taxed. Years ago, Social Security, I believe, was not taxed or was little taxed. And, of course, now it's taxed. And I'm wondering, in the future here, when we baby boomers have billions and trillions of dollars in IRAs, KEOGs, and 401Ks, how are we going to keep Uncle Sam from changing the rules of the game and taxing that? And taxing it possibly as much as when we were earners years ago?
Well, if I
understand, that's not an easy question, but you know, the government spending continues unabated, and they're going to need money, and we've got piles of money sitting there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I understand your question,
in other words, how can we protect the trillions of dollars that we're going to have sitting there in these different funds that supposedly paying us when we're in a lower income rate, and then the government says, "Gee, fellas, we need money, and you guys have all this money from these Roths and IRAs." You know, that was kind of a good deal, so we need some of that. So then all of a sudden, they start chewing away at it, as is the precedent.
Well, the Roth IRA is really the only account that at least presently will allow for the withdrawal of quote-unquote tax-free money. And the reason I keep saying quote-unquote is the part that is untaxed is the earnings or the buildup or the income or the growth or whatever we want to call it about the Roth IRA. We could run through all kinds of assumptions of how many dollars every year were put into a Roth IRA, at what earnings rate they grew, so on and so forth. We could all come down to the calculation of how many principal dollars are in there, which are dollars, by the way, that you've already paid income tax on, and then how many earnings dollars are in there that won't have income tax assessed to them, at least under the present rules of our tax code. But let me remind you that you're absolutely spot on about a couple of important features here. Number one, the trillions of dollars that are in qualified retirement plans already, and the greatest share of those trillions of dollars are already going to be taxed when taken out. So a traditional IRA, a 401k plan, a 403b plan, where people have tax-qualified savings plans now, when they take that money out at time of retirement, every dime of it's going to be subject to ordinary income taxes.
That makes many of these programs not such a good deal. And the reason I mention that is because I've known of people that have worked 40, 50 years who are now in their 70s, and they reflect back and say, gee, you know, what I'm paying on what I'm getting now was almost what I was paying full bore when I started working 40 years ago because of the natural progression of income tax rates.
Right, right. And that gets to a separate issue entirely. You know, if we wanted to devote a show to the discussion of the tax code, I'm sure we could have all of the lines lit all of the time, and we'd probably have a great discussion about it. And I'm not trying to make light of it. You've hit upon an issue that goes to the politics of our tax code. What I wanted to say was, irrespective of what we think the fairness or the circumstance of our tax code is, I think it's a harsh statement to say that these plans are no good or that these plans don't serve their purpose.
Of course, I wasn't so much saying that they were no good. What I'm saying is now they seem very, very good. For example, Social Security seemed like a better deal years ago than it does now. But now all of a sudden the Social Security recipients are saying, hey, wait a second, you guys, you're starting to bite into our Social Security with higher and higher taxes. And, you know, they're saying, shut up, we need the money.
Mm-hmm. Well,
what's to prevent this 20 years from now when I've got my little pile of money there, my little nest egg, and all of a sudden it's taxed 3%, 5%, 7%, 15%?
Yeah, well, again, the greatest share of that money is already subject to whatever income tax rate you will find yourself in when you begin pulling the money out of it. So that is a given now. But I would say that even with that given, for anybody sitting in a position of being able to say, well, should I or should I not use these plans to save for the long term, I think they'll be much happier to be paying taxes on a higher level of income 20 years from now than to have lesser income and pay less taxes. I'm one of the greatest proponents of tax reform that you could probably ever talk to, and I'm not trying to make the next statement that I'll make in defense of our current tax code at all, but here's what I would say. Any investment or savings strategy that is predicated solely on the tax ramifications is doomed to fail. I've seen it time and time again, whether a person makes an investment selection and predicates it on trying to, save the taxes and not pay any more taxes and so on and so forth. The bottom line is this: I'd rather have an income and pay taxes than to not have an income and pay no taxes.
I hope the caller will forgive me for jumping in here because we just got about 10 minutes left and we have the lines are full and we have a lot of other folks, and I want to try to get in some other callers as well. Our guest this morning, Kevin Waspy, he's a lecturer in the Department of Finance at University of Illinois. This is our monthly show on personal finance. He's sitting in for Dave Sinnoh. And we'll try to take as many folks as we can. Going next to a caller in Mattoon, line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was an employee. I was for an organization that had an ESOP program going, and when after I had left there last August, I was notified that my holdings weren't enough to stay in the plan, and they gave me about 2 weeks to get out of it. And I didn't want to have to pay taxes on it, and I thought, well, okay, I'll just roll it into my Roth IRA. And then I found out that you can't do that directly. So what I did was I had to make the withdrawal. I set up an IRA at a local institution in the form of a CD, a two-year CD, which is paying, 6.1%, 6.2%. My question is should I just leave that sit there, do you think, for the 2 years, or if I pulled it out after 6 months, I would lose whatever interest I earned over the 6 months and put it into something else? And I'm just wondering what your suggestion would be in that situation.
I think a two-year CD in the greater scheme of things is a very short time to wait. Perhaps using hindsight, you wouldn't have set up a two-year CD at the time you opened up the account, but 6 months ago you did. I'll tell you one thing. The older I get, the faster time passes. I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I keep seeing that. I keep feeling that every day. And my feeling is a 6% interest rate on a two-year deposit that now only has 18 months to go is certainly nothing to walk away from. What I would say is this. Use the next 18 months to do a little shopping, to do a little self-educating, and find out when that CD comes up for maturity where you would rather have it be.
Okay.
But certainly don't break the money out now.
All righty. One thing, 2 years, I may still be a member at the at a university, either U of I or at another university, and I think at that point I would be eligible for a 403B plan. And if so, is that an option? Could I roll that into a plan like that, or is that not allowed under current rules?
For the best of my knowledge, you would not be able to roll that into a 403B at the university. But again, the benefits people at the university could best answer that. The fact that the money originated in an ESOP plan brings in a couple of interesting twists to it, and I don't want to make a blanket statement, but I think, again, the best answer to that could be from the benefits people wherever you are in 18 months.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
So we'll go next to Wellington, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I have about 3 quick questions, and I'll hang up. Listen, when I give my broker $10,000 to invest in company ABC, does that money go specifically into that company for equity and working capital? That's one question. Second question, if I invest $10,000 in a mutual fund with, say, 100 companies, is that money split up to go into the 100 companies? And on a mutual fund with X amount of companies, is it possible for a mutual fund to literally go broke, or would all companies have to go broke within that mutual fund for it to be down to zero? Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
3 great questions. Let's start with combining the first two. Whether it's a mutual fund or you or I or anyone else purchasing an individual stock. Remember, a mutual fund is nothing more than a pool of investments. It does 2 things. It allows many investors to pool their money to assemble a portfolio of securities. A portfolio means nothing more than a collection. So a collection of stocks, in our example, rather than owning 1 or 2 stocks. So the mutual fund is only a conduit to the same end result, let's say owning equities. But in combining the first 2 questions in that way, let's just say this. What we need to distinguish is between the primary and the secondary markets. Here's what I mean. To specifically answer your question, does my $10,000 go to the company to fund its working capital, to make its widgets, to do whatever it does in its daily operations? And the answer is 99 cases out of 100, no. When a person makes an investment in the stock market, quote unquote, they're investing in a pool of securities already in the hands of other investors. This is what we call the secondary market. These are securities that have been issued in the past by the companies that issued them, who are now trading between investors. So when I buy 100 shares of General Motors stock, I'm buying it from some other investor who's selling it to me. General Motors doesn't even know the transaction occurs until their corporate registrar tells them that Joe Smith is no longer the owner of the stock and Kevin Waspy is. So that's a secondary market transaction, and that's all of what we see when we see Wall Street, whether it's the Dow Jones Industrial Average reported or what's going on, all secondary market transactions. Now, that's a very important function, though, because that provides liquidity to all of those investors who do bring investment capital to a company in what's called the primary market. The primary market is where you'll hear terms such as initial public offerings of common stock of companies. So in that case, and in that case only, the company is tapping the capital markets, the public capital markets, to raise money for its operations. So how much of those funds go into the actual property, plant, and equipment that end up being those pieces of equipment that stamp out the widgets that the company makes have to come through the public capital markets. We teach students that public capital markets in this country are some of the most developed in the world, and it's one of the best things and one of the greatest indicators of our productivity of our economy, because investors in those markets continue to supply the liquidity and make possible those small companies to come into the capital markets in these initial public offerings. My guess is, if people were never allowed to sell the stock that they bought when they buy it from the company, the number of investors lining up to buy that stock from the company would be a whole lot fewer. So that basically is the distinction between primary and secondary markets. Third question, very quickly, can mutual funds go broke? I suppose in the classic sense of saying the investments in the funds determining the share value, the funds could go broke if they were leveraged mutual funds. In other words, they borrowed money to buy stocks, and in doing so bought stocks of losing companies such that the value of the companies declined to a level less than what was owed on the outstanding debt. Levered mutual funds are very uncommon. It would be very unusual for a mutual fund to go broke unless it were a leveraged or used debt, borrowed money in its operations. But we have heard of things that are, for the lack of a better term, private mutual funds called hedge funds. Hedge funds can go broke because hedge funds in many instances do use a lot of leverage, a lot of financial borrowings to finance their investment operations. So in a private sense, those I think we could say could go broke.
And I think we're going to have to stop because we're just about at the end of the time. I'm sorry we have one caller we can't take, but next month, I think Dave probably will be here. We'll do this again. In the meantime, if you're interested in finding out what's been going on the stock market and you're interested in trying to learn more about investing, you could look for the program Wall Street Week, which is on WILL on Friday nights at 7:30. Then for personal finance advice and information, there's a program we have here on Saturdays that might help you out. It's called Sound Money at 10 o'clock. And there is on that show, then again, the possibility to call in and ask specific questions about your financial situation. So you might want to check that out. And we want to say to our guest here this morning, Kevin Wasby, thanks very much for being
here. Thank you, David. It's been a lot of fun.
Our guest, Kevin Wasby, he's a lecturer in finance at University of Illinois.